More Current State live storytelling set for next Wednesday evening at Red Cedar Spirits in East Lansing. Hope you can join us at 6 o'clock over there on Merritt Road. The theme for our storytellers is The Heat Is On. The Heat Is On at Red Cedar Spirits, 6 o'clock. If you'd like to become a storyteller, we still have room for more. Visit our Facebook page, please, at Pop-Up Stories Lansing. Hope you do it. It's Current State here on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Last week on his HBO show, John Oliver of Last Week Tonight made a point about the broadcast media's reliance on print journalism. It was a mashup of references to newspaper stories by TV news hosts.
According to the Chicago Tribune.
According to the Detroit Free Press.
According to the San Francisco Chronicle.
According to the Times-Picayune.
The Boston Globe.
The Orlando Sentinel.
The Philadelphia Inquirer.
The Pittsburgh Tribune Review.
The Detroit News.
And the Houston Chronicle reports.
The Los Angeles Times reports.
Now, Oliver also revisited many profound changes that have transformed journalism, many would say for the worse. But perhaps the biggest of those changes, the internet, has also played a role in energizing another kind of reporting, citizen journalism. The internet has meant that ordinary citizens can play a greater role in reporting news. Today we'll talk with two Lansing area citizen journalists about what they do, why they do it, and the difference they're trying to make. First, Alice Drager. Alice is the founder, board president, and journalist at eastlansinginfo.org, a free East Lansing news website. Welcome back, Alice.
Thanks.
Also, Steve Harry, who wears all the hats, researcher, reporter, fact checker, editor, you name it, at steveharrypublicpolicy.com. Steve, welcome.
Thank you.
Alice Drager, we had you on just as East Lansing Info was launching a couple of years ago. Remind us why you launched East Lansing Info.
Well, I could see, as somebody who does journalism at the national level, exactly what John Oliver was describing, namely that local news was dying because of the internet. What was going on was groups like Gannett were buying up local newspapers. They own, for example, the Lansing State Journal, and basically reducing the number of reporting staff as much as possible to maximize profits. And it's not that the LSJ reporters are bad. They're terrific reporters, and they do really important work. But they've been cut back, and that meant that we don't have news reporting on East Lansing. Frankly, what sells well in terms of clicks is things like murders and scandals, and East Lansing doesn't have a lot of murders and scandals. What we do have is tax problems, budget issues, sidewalk concerns, festivals. And so we really needed reporting on those kinds of issues. And I could see that that was really lacking. When I myself went to city council meetings, there was so much going on that my neighbors didn't know about. They were voting in ways that were completely uneducated. They didn't understand why their taxes kept going up. So I really felt it was important to bring local news to the people of East Lansing so that they could be educated voters, so they could be engaged citizens, so they could get to know each other, and they could get to feel like East Lansing was a real place.
And Steve Harry, you're a one-man operation, I take it. One guy doing research, writing stories, and opinion as well. How did you get started?
Well, I ran for state representative against Joan Bauer in 2008. And I created a website for that. And then when I lost badly in that, I took some of the issues that I'd posted about my campaign and transferred that to just a general website to talk about issues, policy. So that was the start of it. And I think I've always been interested in issues and needed a place to put it besides writing letters to the newspaper. So came along, and it was a great thing.
Alice has spoken about what she's trying to accomplish with East Lansing Info. At the end of the day, what are you trying to accomplish with your modest operation?
Well, I'm interested in making change, I think, to policy and state law and local law and everything. So I'm interested in several different areas, no specific area.
Who's public policy? Oh, okay, so you move around state of Michigan, city of Lansing, Ingham County.
Even national issues.
Okay. Alice, is there a focus on particular issues at East Lansing Info?
We focus very specifically on what's of concern to people in East Lansing. So we don't cover national. We rarely even cover county level stuff unless there's some specific thing affecting specifically East Lansing. And we use a model that's a nonpartisan, non-editorial, non-commercial model. So we're basically similar to public radio, except that we are online only and we're print, essentially online. So we try very hard to be a place where people can come for accurate, factual news. We try to be comprehensive. Obviously, we can't cover everything. But one of the services we provide, for example, is our weekly council capsule, which one of us goes to the council meeting and sits through the entire thing and writes up everything that happened at council in terms of a summary. So that even includes the consent agenda, things like little tiny budget items being passed. We make sure
that... You don't cherry pick. You put it all
out
there.
We cover it all. Yeah. And I sometimes joke about, you know, sending it out over Facebook and Twitter as, here's your weekly boring council capsule. Except there's always something interesting going on. And often it is the subtle stuff in the consent agenda, which is a non-discussed agenda that's going on. And so we really dig through hard through the agendas of what's going on. So last week, for example, I went to Transportation Commission because I could smell something on the agenda was interesting. Normally, I don't go to Transportation Commission, but it turned out I was correct. There were three really interesting things going on at Transportation Commission. One was discussion of how to get bikes to finally be really tolerated in East Lansing. One was the bus rapid transit, the BRT project. And the other one was the corner, the blighted corner in East Lansing. The developer was there to talk about what they were going to do in terms of traffic. And that meant I got the scoop on the story of what they're planning to build at that corner. And we were the only people, we're still the only news organization to have the news about what they're planning to build there.
We're talking with local citizen journalist Alice Drager of ELI, that stands for East Lansing Information, a free East Lansing news website at eastlansinginfo.org. Also, Steve Harry joins us. Steve researches and writes about local policy at steveharrypublicpolicy.com. Steve, every news gatherer wants to break important news or advance important news. Can you look at your work and say, hey, I made a difference here, or I moved this forward, or I put this on the table?
One instance, I don't know if it really caught the public attention, but I did post some information on Peter Lark's salary and his rapid increases in salaries after he took the position. And I had that out there long before it became known that he had this huge golden parachute when he did leave here recently. Now, problem is that you could look back and say, oh, I told you so, but it didn't. I don't have enough readership that it actually made news at the time.
You are a one-man thing, though. Do you get any help from anybody, or
is it all
you? Alice, what about ELI? How many people are involved in this effort?
A huge number, actually. And part of what we're trying to do is cultural change. We're trying to get citizens to feel more awake, more like journalists in their own town. And so Ann Nichols, who's a lawyer, actually runs our operation as our managing editor and does a phenomenal job bringing in reporters, managing stories, bringing a mix to the people of East Lansing. We've had now about 80 people be reporters for us. Some of them just are one-time reporters, but many of them are regular reporters. Right now we have about 12 regular reporters reporting on a regular basis. When I do payroll next week, I'll probably write 14 checks for this month. We run right now on about $45,000 a year. It's a very small operation financially, and that's because a lot of people donate their service and everybody else is underpaid. We are supported by our donors. So far, 100% donor funded. And we're succeeding, but it is a difficult thing to do in terms of making the money work. But part of what we're trying to do is get people to realize everybody can be a reporter and get people focused on the idea that they need to do reporting in a way that's accurate, factual, nonpartisan, so we can bring news to the people that's accurate.
Steve Harry, do you know how many readers you have? Is there a way to know that? Do you track that?
Yeah, it's somewhere over 3,000, but I think about 3,000.
Do you know who your readers are?
Yes.
Is there a pattern
exactly
there to who reads your stuff?
Whoever I send my, I have a list of emails, and I send everybody a notice when I post something new.
Okay.
So I know exactly who they are.
Alice, what about you? How many web visitors do you have? And do you know who your readers are?
We do, because we've done all the analytics possible to try to figure out who those folks are. They're people focused in East Lansing, although we have a few people in towns neighboring by. We have thousands of readers every week. We have 1.9 thousand likes on our Facebook page now. We have about 700 people signed up on our Twitter account. We have hundreds of people signed up on our weekly digest. Our weekly digest is free, and it gives you a full rundown of everything that we reported that week and what's coming up the next week in East Lansing. So we've seen our influence rise tremendously. And I also see it in ways that are not measurable in terms of numbers, but things like when I now go to the Downtown Development Authority with a new reporter who I'm showing the ropes to, the people on the DDA make a point of coming over and saying hello and meeting the new reporter, whereas a year ago, they kind of didn't want to talk to me so much. So we're definitely seeing the influence. We see things like with the ethics ordinance that was passed by our city council, which they're not actually following, that when we report that they're not following their own ethics agenda, it ends up back on their agenda to discuss. So we see the influence of our work out there. We saw, for example, the last city council election, one of the highest rates of voting in terms of people going out and voting. And we believe that's because we bothered to bring people campaign finance information, voting records, information about the candidates that was actually meaningful. And for the first time, they didn't only have to rely on what gets mailed to them by the candidates. We could actually give them much more information about who's who.
Steve, Alice is going to write, I think, a dozen checks, you said, here at the end of the month. Do you realize any dollar gain from what you do?
This is all a drain on my pension. I pay for it all, and it doesn't cost very much. It costs me about $150 a year to have the website. Beyond that, it's just a freedom of information request once in a while.
And I should mention, Mark, I don't get paid by East Lansing Info. I donate about 30 to 40 hours a week, and I would agree with Steve. It's a drain on my time and a drain on my money. We're also, my husband and I are the lead financial donors to ELI, so I don't make money off of it. I'm doing it because I think it's a critical public service to educate the people of East Lansing about their own town.
We're talking with local citizen journalist Alice Drager of ELI, East Lansing Information. That's at eastlansinginfo.org. Also, Steve Harry, who researches and writes about local policy at steveharrypublicpolicy.com. Steve, I know some trained journalists, college-educated in journalism, think that only a certain amount of training can result in a truly competent journalist. What do you think?
Well, I think it would certainly help. I think one thing I'm lacking is knowledge about how to do research and where to find information and that sort of thing. So although I can do quite a lot, there's probably a lot of areas that I'm lacking, and a little training would have helped.
But to the extent that you do consider yourself qualified, what qualifies you?
I think I started out in my job as a procedure writer, so I learned how to write fairly clearly, and so I'm able to put ideas across fairly well, and maybe a unique perspective.
I think minus any formal education, I imagine the learning process is rich, even if you do have a degree in journalism. Here, you jump into this business, you learn a lot.
You do. And, you know, I have a background as a historian. So my PhD is in history and philosophy of science. And so I know how to do historical research. But you're right. Anne is a lawyer, our managing editor, Anne Nichols. But even the two of us continue to learn things about how to do research. But a lot of it is perseverance. And a lot of it is just a willingness to make sure that we're comprehensive in terms of trying to understand all the sources and ask people the questions. So we train our reporters that, you know, there are ways you can look things up, but the main thing you need to do as a reporter is be open to the facts and have perseverance. Just press and press and press in terms of trying to find out what's really going on. That means using the Freedom of Information Act. It means calling people. You know, it means picking up the phone. And last week, I had to, or 2 weeks ago, called the Department of Environmental Quality, the DEQ, about a question about East Lansing. Or you pick up the phone and you call the EPA in Chicago and you ask them questions.
Steve Harry, how long do you intend to be doing this?
I'm enjoying it.
So. Do you have a vision of the future, or is it just is the future as stripped down as the present?
I don't think that I'm going to be stopping anytime soon.
Okay.
I'm enjoying it.
But do you intend to grow your operation at all? Or do you like the independence of just being a one-man shop?
I think it works real well the way it is.
Yeah, yeah. No, I can understand the appeal of that, to tell you the truth. Alice, Eli's just a couple of years old. You're at it and appear to be growing. Do you expect to be at this a long time?
I would ultimately love to become just a reporter for Eli. That's the part of it I enjoy. Like Steve, that's the part I really enjoy doing. But I would love to replace myself on the board and certainly replace myself as the person who runs the small business, because running a small business turns out to be a heck of a lot of work. And that's not where my interests lie. But I'm willing to do that as long as I have to bring the people of East Lansing the news that our terrific reporters are bringing them, because I think my team is doing a phenomenal job. And I love employing people who are stay-at-home parents, retirees, people who are students. We have East Lansing High School students, MSU students, LCC students. We've got folks from all over the community working to basically share a community vision of accurate information and lots of news.
You both got into this to some extent because you both feel strongly about issues and policy. Is it challenging transitioning from engaged and opinionated to detached and objective? What about you, Steve?
I don't really feel a great need to be objective. That's the nice thing about this is I can report facts and try to get all the information correctly, but I can also inject a lot of opinion and a point of view to it.
What about Eli? Is there opinion on Eli, and what about that difference between being opinionated and being objective?
Well, you know, objectivity is a goal. It's not a magical thing you can somehow simply reach just by wanting to get there. But we work really hard on checking each other to try to remove any kind of editorial statements. We try to watch really carefully the way that we're shaping stories. But I'll tell you, the thing I feel really non-objective and passionate about is the idea that bringing news to people is something that's critically important in a democracy. So when at the last council election, for example, I went and voted, and then my son and I spent the evening at the city clerk's office looking at the returns, and I felt very strongly that I really was so excited by the voter turnout. It didn't matter to me who got elected. I just felt like we had helped people feel that voting mattered. Mm-hmm. And so I was just so excited to see the numbers of people going to the precincts. What depressed me is the students were not engaged. We saw very low student turnout. But what we saw all over town was numbers that we hadn't seen before in terms of people coming out to vote. And that just made me feel really super excited.
We want to thank both of our guests, local citizen journalist Alice Drager of Eli. That's East Lansing Information, a free East Lansing news website at eastlansinginfo.org. Also, many thanks to Steve Harry, who researches and writes about local policy at steveharrypublicpolicy.com. Thanks to both of you, and good luck.
Thanks,
Mark. Thank you.
The YMCA of Metropolitan Lansing just launched the Healthy Living Mobile Kitchen. We will talk with President and CEO Jeff Scheibel and Kitchen Manager Ashley Beversdorf to find out how it works. That's coming up on Current State. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR, always at WKAR.org. This weekend, the Broad Art Museum on the MSU campus has a new six-month-long exhibit opening. The curator of this eastward-looking project stopped by WKAR to discuss his vision. Current State's fine arts reporter Jamie Paisley has more.
Back in 2012, Dr. Wang Chun-Chen became the first China-based curator ever hired at an American art museum, and that museum is the Eli and Edith Broad Art Museum in East Lansing. Chun-Chen, as he prefers to be called, has returned to the Broad with a new exhibit opening this weekend called Fire Within, A New Generation of Chinese Women Artists. It will run through mid-February of 2017. In speaking with Chun-Chen, originally I assumed he defines that the contemporary era of this new generation to be since Mao Zedong's so-called Great Leap Forward, with its radical modernization of industry still being felt in China. However, he views contemporary as jumping well ahead of those 1950s and 60s.
I define contemporary art in China, including women artists, because they are quite different from before. There are several branches or styles of art in China. One is a very traditional one is very officially, one is very independent by the artists. When you look at the contemporary art in China, you could tell them from the traditional one, from the official ones. It's very distinguishing, and people can judge that from the appearance and the idea hidden behind all this art. Because contemporarily often means today or present.
Yeah.
So we just want to see the new one, the individual one, and also very creative one can be defined as a contemporary.
Zhen Zhen explains that previously, as art education came to China, well, it was focused mainly on realism, landscape painting as proper expression. That view has been changing over the past 30 years or so.
So now in China, the young generation, they try to, one of the main ideas is they just want to be more unique, more creative. So that is why they try to just say, I want to be a real artist, so I should find or make my own styles. So even for this exhibition in Broad Art Museum, we can find that they just look for special material. They find some, even some stories just linked to their own life. No other person can feel if they don't read their stories.
An example of this intensely personal storytelling featured in the Broad Museum's Fire Within is artist Hu Jiayi.
You know, she traveled to Japan for her study. She grew up in Japan. After several years, she returned to China. Then she studied in China. So she got a lot of different cultures, including Japanese one and the Chinese one. So she had a different experience as her parents. So that is why she can take the photos about her girlfriend when she pregnant. You know, such a kind of photography or expression you couldn't imagine before. People don't dare, even don't, they didn't dare to take the pregnant women as the works. So the young generation of Chinese women artists, they are very courageous, very bold. Sometimes still, some of them very conservative or still keep their own traditional life instinct. Before 1979, you couldn't teach any modern art from the Western European, it means Western art. So the artists today in this exhibition usually grew up during the 1980s and 1990s. That period is just the opening up to the world, I mean to the Western, especially to the Western countries, not only about the ideologically knowledge, you know.
Fire Within, A New Generation of Chinese Women Artists, is the exhibit opening this weekend and is jointly organized by the Central Academy of Fine Arts in Beijing, as well as the Broad Art Museum at Michigan State University. Dr. Wang Chunchen is heading up this new exhibit, though his relationship with the Broad extends back to its opening.
You know, I was invited as adjunct curator in 2012 by the previous founding director, Michael Rush. So I respect him very well. Of course, for me, I like to introduce more Chinese new art to American audience. The first one is called Future Returns, which was held in 2 years ago. So this year, just in the same galleries on the second floor, I know this is a bigger floor and with three different rooms. I want to include my exhibition into three sections. The first one is confront traditions. It's kind of like confronting, because even the young generation of Chinese, including women artists, want to look for their own methods of special art. But still, they are not satisfied with what they have learned or taught. So that is why confronting traditions. You can find the conflicts among Chinese tradition or traditional cultures.
Alongside the section titled Confronting Tradition, the next step Chun Shan explores with the Chinese women artists is the shifting identities.
What is the real Chinese identity? From their own works, you can find that such a mixture On the one side, they are very international or very open. On the other side, they are struggling for their own feeling, sometimes for women. Because women in Chinese, the term is sometimes a political term, sometimes it's just an individual term. Sometimes it's a very contradictory definition to be given to the women.
Yeah.
Because it's not easy. Today, women lives in China or living in China becomes more self-independent. But still sometimes socially not well treated. For example, if they look for a job, if they are women, then maybe sometimes they don't treat them equality.
And just as the section Chen Chen calls Shifting Identities begins to deal with issues of gender for these women artists, the third and final portion, Body as Sight, of the Broad's new exhibit Fire Within, continues along that path.
It is called the Body as a Sight. It means it is a focus, include everything, tradition, identity, culture, even body itself. Because this term or this theme is strongly linked to contemporary art. Traditionally in China, body, the person's body, is not highly regarded as a wonderful art expressions. But now, body becomes more important. Maybe this is, if you take your body as very important, even as your own self, because we often say, traditionally in Chinese culture, body doesn't belong to your own self because it is socially constructed. For example, in your painting or in your works, you cannot, in nude, you must put the clothes on their own body. Because, you know, in the past century, if the models, but that has become a controversy. They said this is so terrible. It's not moral if you look at the person in nudity, something like that. So body has become a very important topic. And people like to say, body is myself. I can take my body as my own property, my own expressions. It belongs to me. No other person can control it. It's interesting. That is why body becomes very important for contemporary artists, including women artists. Even they don't do it so boldly, so explicitly. It means it's not so clearly. It's not so open. It's not so rude or so aggressive for the people's visuality. But still, the body as a kind of meaning is strongly expressed in their own works.
For Chen Chen and the new Broad exhibit opening this weekend, Fire Within, it is that pivot for the new generation which takes center stage.
All the young generation of artists, they got the modern education, not the traditional, you know, Chinese education. So they learned a lot of new knowledge, especially about art. Because in our curriculum, you know, a lot of Western or European art, or including art history, are taught to students. Also China, you know, maybe more than 100 years ago, they brought the education system into China, including art, because traditionally we don't take realism as very important. They just stress expressionism. Because I know this term is very difficult to be understood as Chinese ones. But for example, why Chinese people look like the landscape painting in China is called a sanshui hua, or maybe the flower and the birds painting, because they think that kind of things is a real art for people to feel, to enjoy, not just to understand this, you know, real world. So that is why after generation, just repeat the models. But for the Western art history, they like to see one new model replaced the older one, especially the modernist art.
You can see that new wave of Chinese women artists this weekend at the Broad Art Museum in East Lansing. Fire Within, as curated by Dr. Wang Chunchen. More information can be found online at broadmuseum.msu.edu. For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And coming up on Current State, states and provinces that border the Great Lakes and the St. Lawrence Seaway invest millions of dollars to track and control invasive species. A new tool developed by the Ann Arbor-based Great Lakes Commission promises to make that task a little easier. Current State's Kevin Lavery has the story coming up on Current State. We referred earlier to the broadcast media's reliance on print journalism. To wit, Rochelle Riley in today's Detroit Free Press writes that Attorney General Bill Schuette has suggested that his investigation won't end until he's determined the role that everyone played in the Flint water crisis. I'll quote here from Rochelle Riley's column today. When asked whether that investigation could lead to the governor's office and charges against Rick Snyder, Schuette said in an interview with me Monday night, "You take it one step at a time and nobody's off the table. That's how an investigation should be conducted." Tip of the hat to Rochelle Riley at the Free Press for that one. According to a 2009 Feeding America study, 1 in 4 mid-Michigan children will go to bed hungry tonight. The YMCA of Metropolitan Lansing has an idea that might help change that statistic. They've been sponsoring community feeding programs since 2011, but this new idea, the Healthy Living Mobile Kitchen, is going to reach even more people in need. Here to tell us all about it is the president and CEO of the YMCA of Metropolitan Lansing, Jeff Scheibel. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, good morning, Mark.
And Ashley Beversdorf is kitchen manager of the Mobile Kitchen. Hi, Ashley.
Hi, good morning.
Jeff, describe your mobile kitchen, please. How big is it? What does it look like?
Well, we're really so excited, A, to be on your show and to really to be able to talk about what we think is an essential element in our work, in our community's work, in regards to our anti-hunger initiative. Our mobile kitchen, actually, the thought germinated about a year and a half ago because, as you shared just a minute ago, is our organization has been in the year-round feeding business since 2011, but unfortunately the statistics are so staggering that not one organization can conquer this, but collectively, in partnership and collaboratively with other organizations, we can make huge strides. We knew the statistics, but we also knew that there's barriers affected with getting food into the bellies of hungry kids, and one of those is transportation. There are many food deserts in the Tri-County area and the greater Lansing area that there's need, but unfortunately the kids in need can't get to the locations. And so the idea of how do we get to them germinated about a year and a half ago. We actually picked up on the idea from a YMCA in North Carolina, and really, in essence, what it allowed us to do was to take a 54-passenger school bus, refurbish it, which meant kind of take out all the insides and restack the deck with food distribution space, as well, which that's job number one for the mobile kitchen, is to get food into the bellies of hungry kids. But the second part that we're really passionate about is we want to be able to do more than that. And part of that is creating kind of an education, which is an opportunity for kids and parents on how to do some simple exchanges, integrating more fruits and vegetables into their diet and maybe a little bit less on processed foods. And then we also integrate an hour's worth of activity. And so I think the combination of those two really led to the concept of the mobile kitchen. And I tell you what, we did our press conference about a week ago, and the excitement level is beyond the meter. We're really ready to go.
Ashley, as Jeff alluded to, you just had the launch. What do the kids say about this?
Their reaction was like what made me the happiest. They were so excited about it. They, Miss Ashley, do you drive this bus, and is this going to be coming to visit us? So I think what the kids love is it brings excitement to fruits and vegetables and to nutrition. And that's, you know, what I love is getting them excited about that, and it really makes them feel a part of something. And it's really an exciting time for the communities that we're in at the moment.
Jeff, just a minute ago, you alluded to, quote, many food deserts in the Lansing area. Go a little bit deeper with us here. How many people are impacted by this from your perspective?
Well, we know that in the various counties, we know specifically the general population of the statistics on hunger facts. And in Ingham County, approximately 17% of our population falls into the range of the need for food insecurity. And then the statistics really across the Tri-County area are similar, maybe not as large. Like, we know that Clinton County is approximately 12%. You know, Eaton County is approximately 13%. And so in our general area, we know that there are a number of great organizations that already have stationary distribution centers for families and kids who can access those. But we also know in the vast area of country and transportation as a barrier, there's just hundreds and thousands of people who still are hungry but can't get to these locations. And I think that's the neat part about our ability to access those areas, because different than our stationary friends, we have wheels. And so our mobility is really going to allow us to kind of make a difference. And this past year, we started, and of course, as I said at the beginning, Mark, we're not in this alone. There's an incredible amount of community support and community organizations that we already partner and collaborate with. And at the beginning of this year, we all convene once a month. And part of what we do is strategically take a look at our big map and do a couple things. Number one is to identify those key areas and to make sure we're not doing double coverage, because the last thing we want to do is oversaturate an area with multiple organizations doing good.
Ashley, let's bring Ashley into this. Where have you gone? Where are you going with the mobile kitchen?
Right now we have four locations we're visiting. We're at a few apartment complexes, a few parks throughout the community. We're in like Summer Place apartments. We're at Baker DeNore. We're kind of all over the place, and that's what's nice about the mobile kitchen, is it allows us to visit, you know, various sites and not just narrow in on one area of the community.
Ashley, what kind of food is made in the kitchen? Tell us more about your offerings.
Well, right now, at the moment, we have a partnership with Sodexo and Meetup to Eat Up. So there are our meals at the moment are, you know, we have carrots, broccoli, yogurt, sandwiches that are made for the kids. So we'll really get into the creation of meals on the mobile kitchen in the fall, but right now we're just using those meals that are given to us through our program.
And just make clear here, when the bus is coming down the street, what do people see? How does the bus look? What color is it? That kind of thing.
Oh gosh, it's every color you can imagine, and it's covered with, you know, every fruit and vegetable you can imagine. We have an avocado on there, we have pumpkins, we have corns, apples, you know, you name it, we have it. So yeah. I think that's really what, you know, people, their heads are turning and people are pointing, and it's awesome.
You know, it's about food from a half a mile away. It sounds.
Oh yeah,
like.
you definitely know what our message is.
Jeff, talk to us a little bit more about your partnership with the Lansing schools. How does that work?
Oh, absolutely. Well, and you know, we for years we have, because we're in the same business of working with kids and families, our relationship with the Lansing schools has gone back years. Ashley talked a little bit about the partnership with Sodexo Magic, especially as it relates to the food side. But we also partner with Lansing Schools in a variety of functions on the food side. You know, back in 2011, you know, that's really when we first launched into our anti-hunger initiative, which became branch-based initiatives and opportunities to feed kids. And then we realized the magnitude, and then that in 2013 that expanded to all nine of our before and after school sites that we partner with the Lansing schools on. And so without their support, and that's one of those items that I was talking about a few minutes ago, where it's really the collective impact of us working together that makes a big difference, you know, for the kids. You know, the nice thing about the mobile kitchen too, Mark, is even though we're kind of early on getting that on the road, that whole education side, it's an interactive teaching model, because we'll have movable workstations for kids and families as they work and learn new opportunities of putting healthier food groups together. Especially that'll be really important, because so many of our families are have financial restrictions.
Understood. So, we've been speaking with Jeff Scheibel, president and CEO of the YMCA of Metropolitan Lansing, and Ashley Beversdorf, kitchen manager of their newly launched program, the Healthy Living Mobile Kitchen. We learned a lot. Thank you, Jeff and Ashley.
Thanks for having us on, Mark.
Its current state on WKAR. Millions of dollars are spent each year across the Great Lakes to control the spread of invasive species, from quagga mussels found in the ballast water of seagoing vessels to Asian carp. Environmental officials keep a close watch on organisms that might disrupt the natural ecosystem. The Ann Arbor-based Great Lakes Commission is developing a new online tool to aid the prevention of invasive species in the lakes. It's called Gladiator, which stands for Great Lakes Detector of Invasive Aquatics in Trade. Current State's Kevin Lavery spoke with project manager Erica Jensen about what the software's designed to do.
We have a number of non-native species that have become established in the Great Lakes region over a number of years. Some of which are highly invasive and have many people are familiar with, including the sea lamprey, zebra and quagga mussels. And we're also actively trying to prevent the introduction of new non-native species that we think are a threat to our ecosystem and economy, like species of invasive carp.
Now, before this software program was developed, Gladiator, what was really the way in which organizations like yours tried to track what was coming into the environment that was not native and causing some sort of a harmful effect?
Well, there are a number of pathways that invasive non-native species could get into the Great Lakes region. A number of high-profile pathways that we look at in terms of prevention include maritime commerce and ballast water, connecting canals and waterways, open waterways that connect our system to other water systems, and things like the live organism trade, so species that are bought and sold for use in aquariums, water gardens, or use as live bait, for example. So we are involved in several initiatives and projects with our partner states and provinces and other organizations to try to manage these pathways and prevent species, non-native species that we think might be invasive to the Great Lakes region from getting here through those pathways.
Okay, so you talk about live organisms in trade and things that are bought and sold. So we're not necessarily talking about someone who, or a person or an organization that has malicious intent that is trying to introduce something like Asian carp, for example, into the Great Lakes ecosystem. These are more commonly people, as you say, who buy backyard plants for their ponds or fish for their ponds that, again, are not native to the Great Lakes. So that sounds like that's really the main thrust of what Gladiator is tracking.
Yes, that's the focus of this project.
And the extent to which the sale of an organism is legal or illegal really is dependent upon what the species is and what the regulations are in that particular state. So it isn't like species are trafficked into a place.
Right. So the federal government, as well as our states, have regulated species lists. So they have developed lists of species they think are harmful to the ecosystem or the economy of the region and regulate those species. And in many cases, those species are prohibited from possession, transport, or sale. We are working hard in the Great Lakes region to make our lists consistent, but we still have a bit of a patchwork between our states and provinces as well as the federal government.
We're talking with Erica Jensen. She's the project manager with the Great Lakes Commission, and she's part of a team that is developing a tool called Gladiator. That stands for Great Lakes Detector of Invasive Aquatics in Trade. About how many species are on this list that you're tracking at any given time?
We have compiled a list of about 166 species that we're looking for right now, and we may change that list going into the future as risks evolve or new species are brought into trade.
What are certain states doing to get a handle on controlling what's populating their areas? I know different parts of the country have different concerns, and specifically what's happening in Michigan.
researchers as well as agencies are doing comprehensive risk assessments on various species to determine whether a species is suitable for surviving in a particular geographic range. So those risk assessments can be tailored based on the specifics of a geographic area.
Here in Michigan, we hear an awful lot about things like zebra mussels and quagga mussels, and of course, being surrounded by the Great Lakes. Many of those organisms come in through the St. Lawrence Seaway, which basically bisects Canada. And a lot of this comes in through the ballast water of commercial vessels. And there has been some work, I understand, over the years to mitigate that, to reduce the instances of these species coming in through ballast water.
Yes, there has been a lot of work to manage the ballast water pathway. The federal governments of U.S. and Canada, as well as the St. Lawrence Seaway, have a partnership where they're working together to manage the ballast water of ships that are coming in and out of the Great Lakes region to significantly reduce the risk that that ballast water would introduce species into the Great Lakes region. So there has been a lot of work on that pathway over the last 20 years or so to really make significant reductions in the risk that that pathway poses to the Great Lakes.
Is there any way that Gladiator, this software program, can track, I guess for lack of a better word, intent versus ignorance? How many bad actors are out there who are actually trying to bring a species into an area wrongfully, illegally, for profit, et cetera, versus people who, as you say, they have maybe a backyard plant or a fish that they meant for their home and somehow not maliciously ends up in the ecosystem?
Yes, and unfortunately, it is hard to make that distinction, and that's one of the reasons, one of the first actions that we generally take as invasive species managers is education and outreach. So, for example, the Great Lakes Commission sent letters to a number of online retailers that we identified just to educate them on the issues, make them aware that they might be selling species that we are concerned about in the Great Lakes region and don't want to see here. So really the first step is education to address that issue about whether somebody might be intentionally or unintentionally working with these species.
Right. And if you do come across a hit, so to speak, on the website, your agency, the Great Lakes Commission, has no jurisdictional authority in terms of regulation. That's for other agencies. But there are things, I understand, that you can do to inform that particular group of what's happening.
Correct. We do not have regulatory or enforcement authority for cases where a species might be regulated by a state or federal government. But we can help provide that information, direct people to their state invasive species coordinators, to the regulatory information and point them in the right direction and connect them with people who can help them in their state.
Is there perhaps one particular invasive species that you could point to, Erica, that is really causing concrete damage or harm to the ecosystem that you can really point to in a clear way?
Well, the historic and poster child invasive species for the Great Lakes region has been the sea lamprey that when it was first introduced and taking hold in the Great Lakes region, had devastating impacts on our sport fishery and really caused the collapse of some of our valuable sport fish at the time. Now we have a very robust sea lamprey control program that is operated through the Great Lakes Fishery Commission and their partner agencies that keeps that population down to a level that it will not severely impact our fisheries, but it is a ongoing control program that has ongoing costs to operate on an annual basis, and that is a species that we control, but we can never eradicate.
So who do you hope will use this site? Again, I realize that you are still working on this. It's still essentially in development, being refined, et cetera, but what would be a successful outcome in your mind in terms of a particular agency using it for some benefit?
It is our hope that our state, provincial, and federal partner agencies that are actively working to prevent and control the spread of invasive species will be able to use this tool, use the information it provides to target their efforts, to target their outreach, to target their enforcement when necessary, so that they can efficiently use their resources and we can see a real reduction in the availability of Great Lakes invasive species online.
We've been talking with Erica Jensen. She's the project manager with the Great Lakes Commission, and she is part of a team that has developed a software program called Gladiator, Great Lakes Detector of Invasive Aquatics in Trade. This is a system that helps to determine where invasive aquatic species are coming into the Great Lakes area and helps law enforcement to do something about it. Erica, thank you so much for explaining this new software. It sounds like an exciting new program.
You're very welcome. It's been my pleasure.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, hey, it's Friday, which means Live Music Friday. Irish singer-songwriter Brendan Doherty is back for Live Music Friday. His new album is called Feels Like Home. We'll hear some selections and chat him up. Also, former Governor Jennifer Granholm joins us tomorrow on Current State. She will talk with us about the 2016 presidential election. Of course, she is serving on Hillary Clinton's transition team. We'll ask her what she's up to in that capacity and more tomorrow on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Wharf. Katie Cook directed the show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and Drew Hill. The Current State podcast is there 24/7, informative, insightful, indispensable. Everything we do ends up on that podcast. Grab it at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get podcasts. Don't forget, pop-up stories next Wednesday night, Red Cedar Spirits. The theme is The Heat is On, and we're looking for more storytellers, true first-person stories that you can tell, or if you just like to show up and listen to the stories, that's great too. More information at our Facebook page, Pop-Up Stories Lansing. Think about it. We hope you can join us. Have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow.